You direct the light into it, then you see that from the other side of this lens there is this focal point, because of the curvature of this lens, that is making all of those light focus on the single point, and that's your eye. That's how your eyeglasses work. The same story is with the antennas. The only thing is that these particular antennas have the ability to make the lens up to your fantasy. So you could make any kind of aperture just because you're making it from materials that could redirect electromagnetic wave the way that you want. Maybe Dr. Roy could comment on it.
AC2GS, and my signal's louder than you, Claude. Anyway, we kind of talked about that in the good old days. Dick, A2RIW, me, were chatting about metamaterials, that you can organize atoms in a particular arrangement that is normally occurring in nature that we've seen, where it demonstrates weird things like negative refractive indices. You know, most natural materials only have a positive refractive index. They don't have a negative one. So if you use metamaterials, if you engineer on an atomic level, you can build quality into some of these metamaterials that defy normal materials. And, again, one of those is lenses that have a negative refractive index, which do not occur in nature. So I assume that this this material, the DNS, I guess, is a version of metamaterial where you get interesting characteristics. Problem is that the cost of manufacturing is sky high, since you're practically engineering it on an atom by atom level, which gets expensive.
Yes. So actually, if you make like the lenses for your photo camera, they could cost a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars, but they are made from different kind of glass, stacked one after the other because of maneuvering with the focal length of it, and that's how you get the magnification, the focus. On it, this kind of antennas could do exactly the same. So actually, if you're dealing with the antenna, sometimes the antenna on 300 megahertz would need a half of a meter long. In contrast, experimental metamaterial antennas are small as the fifth of the wavelength, and could have further decrease in size, but they perform like those big antennas. So that's the future for microwave antennas at best. Dr. Ray.
Yeah, but the problem right now is the cost factor is ridiculous. Facebook is working on they look like eyeglasses or sunglasses, and they actually are able to project images into people's eyes, and it's kind of a fancy thing. It's very prototype, and it uses a very esoteric piece of metamaterial as a waveguide, as an optical waveguide to feed the LEDs onto the lens that the person sees. And getting it has to be perfect, and the rate that they can generate perfect versions of this is not very good, and it costs something like $8,000 just for the waveguide itself. So, you know, if you're going to have these metamaterials that cost, you know, $10,000, it kind of throws everyone out of the ballpark.
Well, I have a problem with this statement because first, microwaves cost $50,000, and that was in the 50s, actually 60s. And now you can buy for a few dollars because there are many of them. So the same is going to be with metamaterial. There is no special material. It's just a refractive index of those antennas allows most of the signals to push forward, and reflective refractive and reflected indexes are really trimmable by the designer of that antenna, and you can make them also on the PCB, on the piece of electronic board that is used for the electronics that cost pennies. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, AC2GS, you've got to use that reasoning before. Everything is not scalable like microwaves. You know, microwave ovens use magnetrons. It was not that technically difficult to bring down the cost of magnetrons and kind of shrink the size of microwave ovens. But you can't use that as a yardstick for everything in the world. Metamaterials are kind of built one atom at a time. You can't just kind of, you know, you can't go to the metamaterial lab and say, I'll buy a billion of them. And say, oh, well, with a billion, then the cost goes down precipitously. They would probably sell you, I can't even make more than five of these things. So, I mean, that might change in the future, but again, you can't kind of wave the radar range at every problem, because that's not going to solve this one, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree with you, but we are moving up and up and up, and the new transceiver that I was talking about, the triple that I have purchased, but I didn't, it works at 10 gigahertz right now, so, and plus all lower bands. The only thing is it costs a little bit more money, I believe, $2,500 or more. And those antennas would be in use. And the more technology goes, the more of those antennas will be available for cheaper cost. That's what I think. And to
you. Okay, time will tell. In some cases, things become incredibly efficient and inexpensive. But in other things, like battery technology, we've talked about this before, the state-of-the-art battery technology that's in production and commercial use, I think, was perfected 30 years ago. Since then, they've kind of tweaked it around the edges, but really nothing special. So there are some fields where it takes off like a rocket, if you will, and other places like rockets where it doesn't take off like a rocket. Again, we've talked about this before. Rocket propulsion is pretty much very similar to what it was in the 1960s. There are some fields of technology that have advanced faster than we can comprehend, and there are others that just sit there and stare at us.
You have a good point, Dr. Roy. The only thing is that the old technology goes faster and becomes better. New engine made by Elon Musk, which was shown, is made in one piece right now, mostly in one piece, and the cost goes down of 80% down. Now, if we talk about the antennas, the 95% of the input radio signal is transmitted by the U.S. metamaterial antennas. I mean, radiated by the metamaterial antennas. And I wonder what is the efficiency of a regular dipole, not in terms of antenna pattern, but of the SWR.
I'm not sure how different materials are going to affect the impedance and the standing wave ratio. You could have a perfectly resonant antenna made out of copper. No need for 21st century stuff. So, I mean, there are other benefits of using metamaterial. You make it more convenient. You shrink the size and do other things. But as far as SWR, we've had perfect SWRs antennaed before, and we will again.
Okay, so the Wikipedia doesn't specify what do they have in mind, talking about 95% of input radio signals radiated. So I cannot speculate on it.
Okay. I'm not quite sure why being a metamaterial would matter as far as the efficiency, the transfer of energy from electrical currents to electromagnetic waves with as little waste heat created on the side. So, not quite sure. I mean, every so often we've joked on the technical net of would it be nice to have a superconducting antenna, and what would that bring to the experience other than humongous amount of cost and keeping it cryogenically cold and such. But a man can dream.
I have a question related to superconductivity.
ID and say again.
At KA2UTF, you mentioned superconductivity, and I actually had a question in that regard, but not with antennas.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to put you on the list for tonight or not?
See how long the next fellow takes.
Okay. I'll put you on the list, and I'll call you if you're here. Fine. If you're not, okay. Anyway, back to you, Wes.
Yeah, there is another sentence saying the DNG shell becomes a natural impedance matching network for the system. So it looks like naturally impedance matching happens just because it's designed this way. Back to you.
I don't think so. No, the impedance is a function of the resonance of the radiator and position of the antenna feed. If you have a perfectly resonant center-fed antenna, you have all the reactances canceling out. The capacitive and the inductive cancel out. All that's left is the radiation resistance. And if you tap the antenna at its center point with its lowest impedance, it's approximately 50 ohms. There is an effect that ground reflection has that, depending upon how close it is to Earth ground, it might fluctuate. But the primary reason is because of the resonance, not I don't think the material per se. Or any, I don't know, what quality of a material are you altering that should alter its energy transfer? I don't know.
Okay, the next one. Two photons experience time, so theoretically photons, they are timeless relative to their frame of reference, but yet to us, the observer, they appear to exist in time. They appear to come into existence at the later time cease to exist, and they possess the wave characteristic frequency. But Dr. Roy, do photons experience time?
It sort of depends on your frame of reference. As we've mentioned before, good old Albert Einstein, all things are relative, the general relativity or special relativity. It's important to know your frame of reference. From you sitting there looking at a flashlight, a light has time. It starts at the head of the flashlight. It reaches the other end of the room and hits the paint, reflects off, some gets absorbed.
from the frame of reference of the photon, which is a weird kind of thing to think of because as far as we're aware, photons are not conscious things and they don't really perceive reality one way or the other, but from their frame of reference, their lifetime is zero. They come into and out of existence instantaneously. But that's, again, their frame of reference, not yours, not mine.
So, are you saying that photons can have frequency and not see the time?
Yes, because we're the ones perceiving the frequency. In our frame of reference, they do exist for a non-zero period of time. And in that non-zero period of time, they can have frequency. Only in their only frame of in their own frame of reference do you got problems with that.
So photon can move from point A to point B 1 million light years, but that would be 1 million light years for us, for the observer, from your observer's standpoint. But for photon, the photon could be instantaneously in point A and in point B?
Yes. You have the contraction of space and time is not fixed. It depends upon your frame of reference. If something is traveling in a direction, as they get closer and closer to the speed of light, their effective distance shortens. And if it was able to travel at the speed of light, it would shorten to the point where it would be zero distance. So, again, from the frame of reference of the photon itself, there is no significant distance from point A to point B. From your frame of reference, there's a heck of a difference.
Point A is point B.
In the case of the photon, yes. In the case of you looking at things, no. Unfortunately, that's the big problem with relativity. We're kind of used to the idea that a foot is a foot, a yard is a yard, a second is a second, a minute is a minute. But all these things are not fixed. If you have an atomic clock, if you take it up to the top of a hill, it'll read a different time rate than if you have it on the ground.
Another subject would be a puzzle. It's really kind of silly puzzle, but it's a puzzle. Okay, about entropy. So, you're looking at the sun. The sun is hot. The question is sun delivering? I don't know if I use the proper wording for it because Dr. Roy mentioned that I don't use the proper language. Entropy, high entropy photons or low entropy photons? So the question is the sun? So sunlight, we talk about the sunlight because the sun is very hot. Is the entropy essentially a measure of how spread of energy is? I believe it is. And if you consider two systems with the same amount of thermal energy, then the one where the energy is more concentrated is low entropy or is high entropy. Maybe Dr. Roy could reformulate that better.
Okay. AC2GS once again. Entropy is kind of a difficult thing to discuss because it's not one of those things that, you know, if you talk to a person about time, you know, even though they probably would have difficulty really kind of pinning down the details, it's better to talk about that. Entropy is orders of choice. If everything is lined up in one way, it's a low entropy. So entropy kind of came into thermodynamics and such early in the 1800s. In the last century or so, they've been kind of pushing this notion that entropy is spreading out of energy across a given volume. So in other words, a single photon hitting the Earth from the Sun would be a low entropy object. Whereas the photon getting absorbed and part of it getting reflected to a bunch of different photons, part of it being absorbed as kinetic energy in the Earth, part of it being absorbed in a plant and turning to complex carbohydrates and molecular bonds and such, would disperse the energy over a wider area and by definition would increase the entropy. So thermodynamics, the second law of thermodynamics is within a system, the total entropy must increase. And that's what life is, among many other processes, a means for entropy to increase. We take in food, we breathe in air, and we burn it and do things that make the universe more disordered than it was before we interacted. So the more classical term is the degree of disorder, but the more modern concepts tend to promote the idea of spreading out energy across a bigger and bigger volume.
TUTF with a query.
Certainly, Gary.
Well, given that the universe is expanding at an ever-accelerating rate, can we say that eventually it'll reach a level of ultimate disorganization and unrelatedness in its entirety? And does that contradict the law of the conservation of energy?
No. What you're describing is what physicists call the heat death, or the death of heat. It's when everything is spread out so far that nothing interacts with nothing else and nothing much happens anymore. And unfortunately, if you talk to most theoretical physicists, they will tell you that the conservation of energy, which I love, does not hold for the entirety of the universe. When you start to talk about systems that are infinitely large, conservation of energy kind of falls apart. So a lot of physicists don't believe that conservation of mass energy is really a thing when you're talking about, the end of the universe. Such. For little things here on planet Earth, yes, they hold. But for massive things like a infinitely bounded universe, they probably don't.
Deadly unbounded, as it were.
Well, people have interesting ideas. Is the universe flat? Is the universe round? Is the universe saddle-shaped? Within experimental era, it appears to be flat.
The plane of the universe. But if it's if it's diffused to the point of unrelatedness of anything to anything else, its previously existing shape becomes irrelevant as well. No.
Well, I think we're talking kind of higher dimensional aspects where all kind of things cease to make much sense to us three or four dimensional people. But for all intents and purposes, I guess, yeah. I mean, at the point of the heat death, there'll be nothing to ponder about anything anymore.
Okay. Thanks a lot, KATTF.
You're welcome. Wes, back to you.
Okay, so in other words, you're saying that in two systems with the same amount of thermal energy, the one where the energy is more concentrated, low entropy will be hotter. So the sunlight is giving us the low entropy due to the fact that the sun is hot. If we look at the entropy as a measure of how spread of energy out is, and the sunlight is low entropy because the sun is very hot. Entropy is essentially a measure of how spread of energy is. And if you consider two systems with the same amount of thermal energy, then the one where the energy is more concentrated is low entropy, and it will be hotter. Right or wrong?
Right.
Okay, so I think we discussed that. So you're looking at the sun, you're looking at low entropy. You could use that word. Okay. Now, the next subject is monthly charges. But it's actually not about the monthly charges. It's about Adobe being sued by FTC, Federal Trade Commission, and Nikon is buying Red. So instead of giving you the whole story, maybe I start from something that will interest the audience. Okay. Everything is subscription right now. Your printer, your refrigerator, even your car. It's all just another way for greedy corporate acts to wreck in profit. You're forced into renting everything you already own, and their revenue goes up and up. HP DeskJet 2742E printer. You pay $122 for a cartridge, but it stops printing, even if the cartridge is full, till you decide to pay again a subscription called HP Instant Link. Another American, average American spends about $300 a month for monthly fees to watch movies, music, shopping, play video games, watering your plants, using a smart refrigerator, washing your teeth. Software tethering. BMW. You pay $18 per month for heated seats in your car. Or you have them cold. Tesla wants $10 per month for navigation and other features. Mercedes, $1,200 a year for fast acceleration in a car that you pay for. You already bought it. Unlocking the dash cam in that car, $16 a month. Remote starting, $35 a year, and to find car with GPS, $2 a month. And Photoshop, that most of you use, I assume, costs you $263 per year. Okay. There's no smart bassinet, the Aura Ring, the Hatch alarm clock, the Ring camera, and quick coffee pot. Everything is paid for. So, a few days ago, but that was today at that time, which was October 2024, Federal Trade Commission issued the click to cancel rule. The FTC is also going after Adobe and Amazon for shoddy subscription practices. Let me drop. Okay. But the title of that subject was Adobe sued by FTC and Nikon is buying Red. So the thing is that Nikon is the photo camera company, Japanese. And Adobe is used to create, convert, edit, and sign PDF from any device, but also in the photography field and image industry. They created Adobe Premiere, video editing software, and so on. But Adobe is suffering from Blackmagic, which is another company and its competitors. Blackmagic is motion picture oriented, and created the best in the world total environment for editing software to their own cameras and other hardware. And Adobe is only giving you some piece of software that is not exactly working as it should. But the problem started that Adobe software that was one time paid till 2013 and Photoshop that was present on the market since 1998 and Adobe Lightroom that came out in 2007 now, they are paid. They have to pay monthly fees. You cannot have the program, you have to pay monthly fees. Adobe Premiere introduced in 1991 Adobe Premiere Pro in 2003 when Apple was in still, Apple QuickTime was still in beta. In 2007, certain departments of BBC Radio and BBC TV also adopted the software. So unless we have no choice, we do not like to pay any monthly fees. We want to own transceiver antennas and use them when we want them. We don't want to pay monthly for something.
Okay, Wes, you're free to do that. The trouble is that the subscription model is very lucrative. These guys are making money hand over fist. If I count all the subscriptions I have for Amazon, I'd probably start to cry here. It's the nature of things. I'm not quite sure about your refrigerator that you have a subscription to. My refrigerator doesn't have a subscription need, or my oven, or you know. There are some things that just do have subscriptions, and you have to choose whether or not, and you have to remember to cancel them when they're no longer useful to you, and you have to be able to contact these people. And it should be as easy to cancel a subscription as it is to make one. Unfortunately, the laws of business don't really do that. It's very easy. And they'll give you the first month for free, whoopee. And then you try and cancel these things, and you'll go through the rings of hell.
It is actually what FTC has a problem with in terms of those companies also with Adobe. So Adobe made it easy to subscribe in seconds, but hard to stop paid subscription, and it is now being sued by the government. The customer doesn't like additional paid updates, modules, features, when the Blackmagic has it better for free with free software, and that is much easier, crash-free, no internet needed, and everybody can download it in minutes. In a simple language, you pay $299 for studio version of Blackmagic, and you paid nothing for standard version. Or if you don't want to pay, you have a standard version that does almost everything of that. But Adobe may charge you $1,000 per month if you started the project with their software and needed their module to finish and it is not crash-free. So FTC has a problem with Adobe transparency, inappropriate content, high hidden fees. Listen up. It also has a problem with delayed response, forcing you to stay for hours online waiting to cancel services, and then you got charged again. It is not nice if your own stack of pictures was used to train their AI without your consent to make AI-generated pictures. So actually, something that you do that is very specific now can recognize you everywhere. It's like your prints that make you immediately recognize us because you made the pictures. So the bottom line is, if you did nothing, you don't want to have, you don't have to pay anything. But that is not the case with Adobe. So we talked about a subject, some of you were into photography, camcorder filming your family or your shark, and then you were using Polaroid film, Hasselblad, Leica, Pentax, Nikon, GoPro, DJI, Canon, Sony, and Panasonic. But for you to watch the movies, Netflix or cinema, they have their own requirements. While Canon, Sony, Panasonic were taking over broadcasting TV and documentary, trying to screw Panavision cameras. Some old guys remember the Panavision. One guy from Los Angeles, Jim Jennard, made the red camera. that was less expensive and small, say $150,000 for the film camera used that was used by Hollywood till 2018, where Blackmagic made $2,500 film camera that does exactly the same what $150,000 red camera. And the software is free, so Red Empire was ruined. Red One camera was first shipped at August 7, 2007, and by 2011, Red had over 400 employees. Panasonic made Vericam for $28,000, Canon made C300, 400 for $12,000, and all of a sudden, Blackmagic made Blackmagic Ursa camera that cost $2,535. And with OLPF viewfinder, a little bit more than that. So Hollywood and Netflix switched to Blackmagic. Red placed a few cheaper models, but had to give up. And now Nikon is taking over Red. So Japanese got it for cheap, and Red is now gone forever. And Nikon, for the first time in its history, is in motion picture market. Because Nikon was a good camera. I have Nikon. I have lenses. I have everything. That is, and it's like 10 years old right now. It's making absolutely amazing pictures. 24,000 pixels. Beautiful. So the bottom line is, we do not want to pay anything. And FTC made the ruling. If somebody is holding you with charges, and you just click the button and are not released from the charges, they have to pay for it. Dr. Ray.
Yes, well, I hope this law works out. I hope it accomplishes what's necessary. Business always kind of finds a way, unfortunately. Companies make bundles of money doing this, and they really like getting those bundles of money. So we'll see what the future brings. We'll see if they figure a loophole or two or five or 3,000 or so. It's just the nature of business. The business tries to optimize profits.
Right. So I hope that information is helpful to some of the guys. The last one, I would need the help of Paul with that. So the subject started with, this star is older than the universe and scientists can't explain it. It was estimated 2 billion years older than the Big Bang. So the Big Bang happened at 13.8 billion years. And of course, there was an error, but this particular star is called HD 14028 3, and it has also name Meteusel star. Maybe Dr. Roy knows how is the proper pronunciation for it. But then this star has a very unique structure that structure actually made that the age of that star very difficult. It's so big that you could see it without special equipment from the Earth. And it's about, if I remember, 6,000 last year away from us. The article that I sent to Dr. Roy says, talks about stars from population 2 and population 3. They're not, no longer observable. And those stars, that type of stars was to be blamed for the mistake of the scientists. So I wonder if Paul would be able to say a few words about population of those stars. Dr. Roy, pick up, please.
Yeah, Wesley, you just said that you wanted to talk to Paul. You can't talk to both of us.
Okay. Yeah, I thought that you are the boss here, so... Just for the respect of it. Paul, are you still there?
Wes, how are you doing? Very good. Yeah, I saw that email, and I even went up the one of the links that you had with it, and they had a bunch of paragraphs all about it. And even in its own, you know, in that paragraph, I sent that back to you. It basically said that the stars, Methuselah, by the way, that star is not older than the universe. It gave the age, and the age of it is less than the beginning of the universe. So, I mean, even in its own writing, it was saying the opposite. So when I looked at that, I said, you know, let me actually watch this video. And as I'm watching it, sure enough, he went to one commercial after the other, and he was trying to sell some kind of, it looked like a square bottle or a rectangular bottle. And he's pouring it down his throat, and, you know, it's some kind of a medicine. I guess it'll probably make him live forever, you know. So when I see that, now, to me, that's an instant scam. And then, you know, you team that up with an outrageous statement that star is old the universe. I don't know. I'm very careful with all these YouTubes and things that I go to. I go to very few YouTubes because I really want them to be reasonable. You know, there's certain ones I go to. You know, the Everyday Astronaut or Scott Manley, if you go to him, you know, relating to rocket launches. You know, I just don't click on anybody. Anyway, that's what about it. It looks like I just thought to themselves, let's put this on, have some music playing behind it, and have a couple of big words. He was even trying to describe, you know, what happens as the Big Bang, after the Big Bang, and, you know, typical classical stuff from countless books, you know. So I would not pay attention to that article at all. I sent that back to you. I thought maybe you got that. Back to you.
Yeah, the title is clickbait, by the way.
I know. I thought it said clickbait.
Yeah. Gary, you wanted to say something?
From what I'm piecing together here, somebody was claiming there's a star that's older than the Big Bang or something. Well, be that as it may, weren't there some legitimate observations made by the, you know, the new imaging telescopes that are out there of galaxies that are at a point of maturity that doesn't jive with the point in time of the Big Bang?
Yes. Wes is discussing the Methuselah star, which has been investigated for over 20 years, which was initially measured to be approximately 16 billion years old, which is weird, until they kept measuring it more and more accurately, and so far they've shortened its lifespan. It's 12 billion years old. What you're alluding to is some other anomalous readings that we're seeing. There are some astronomers with theories of why we're misperceiving them, that they might not be galaxies, they might be black holes or something else, and there's a whole bunch of different ideas about why it's being misinterpreted, that you know, we haven't gotten it totally wrong. We might need to tweak and adjust the model a bit, but it's not going to break the laws of physics anytime too soon.
Well, Bang is still a theory, no?
Yes. Well, theories are always going to be theories. You can't prove them. Can't go back in time with your Polaroid camera and take pictures. So, yeah, it's going to remain a theory. You know, germ theory is still a theory. You know, I kind of believe that we're made out of cells. I've seen them under the microscope, but if you look it up, it's called the germ theory.
You're lending too much credence to the Big Bang Theory through that comparison. But, nobody believed that there was a start of time before which there wasn't any and that sort of thing. The antinomies, as they're known, did the world have a beginning in time, or was time always present, regardless of all the events that we think happened within it? But that's all metaphysical stuff. I didn't mean to go there. What I meant was, if you did discover a galaxy that seems to be more mature than it makes sense to be at the point in time beyond which it was from the initial Big Bang, then you either have to put in the point in time of the Big Bang farther back, or you have to say that it didn't happen.
Or in the same way with Methuselah's star, you have to backtrack and say, is my observation accurate or am I missing something? And in the case of Methuselah's star, they were missing 4 billion years. So, it's not a fait accompli that this is a mature galaxy that they're seeing at the periphery of the observable universe. There might be a misinterpretation. There might be a mismeasurement. Time will tell. These guys are clever, and they come up with interesting things, and maybe in 10, 15 years, they'll have a good definitive theory to explain it all away. That's a possibility as well. There's already two completely different things about the universe that point to it being approximately 13.8 billion years. There's the cosmic microwave, and there's I keep on forgetting his constant, the astronomer of, how things are accelerating. I just don't remember it. I'm sure someone remembers it. It's a constant. It's an astronomer's constant.
Planck?
Say again?
Planck's constant?
Give a little time for you and you hit to push the button because you get a little distortion at the beginning.
Are you talking about Planck's constant?
No, I'm not talking about Planck. Planck was a physicist. He wasn't an astronomer.
Okay, then I can't remember it either. Anyway, I thought I'd bring that up. We don't have to pursue it any further.
Okay, give me a minute and let me see if I can do a quick Google.
In the meantime, if Paul could say after Dr. Roy about something about population 1, 2, and 3 of the stars, because they have very little of metal, just an interesting subject. And thank you.
Oh, by the way, it's the Hubble constant. Should have remembered. So, Wes, let me see if I can kind of kick this into motion. I think Wes wants you, Paul, to talk about the population 3, 2, and 1 stars in the universe.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that had to do with the initial stars. They were hydrogen, helium, everything got to the point where those things, when they went supernova, when they blew, they created other materials. They created oxygen, they created nitrogen, other atoms besides oxygen and helium. You know, they compressed, and eventually you got that out of those stars when they blew, and then you had the next generation population, I guess they're calling it. And when those stars started coming into existence, and they went nova, supernova, as they blew, Once they got up to the the highest one was the carbon, I think, and then after that, iron came into play. But then as they accelerated and crashed into each other when they exploded, they created an even higher atomic number, elements, and so on. I think that would be number three, population three. That's the way I remember it. Different generations of stars. So they're saying that was population two. I think they said in that article. So there you go. You know, what we live is, our sun is population three. Back to you, Wes.
Okay, so my understanding is that each population group shows the trend where the lower metal content indicates the higher age of the stars. So sun is considered population one, and relatively high 1.4 metallicity level. I'm reading from the article. So, if we say that most of those stars doesn't exist any longer, means that low metal or low iron stars died faster, and you could say a few words about it, Paul.
Oh yeah, the biggest stars in the beginning, when they compressed at a higher rate because of the gravity, and so they lasted for a shorter period of time. We have stars now that'll probably last until maybe a trillion years from now. They'll still be there, you know, until you wind up with a big chill and everything, you know, gets even further apart, starts ripping the atoms apart, starts ripping the electrons themselves apart, you know. Eventually, you'll probably just wind up with energy. So, basically, the biggest stars, when they blow, they last for a shorter period of time. I think the next one near us is Betelgeuse, and they expect that thing to go nova anytime soon, you know, within maybe hundreds or a couple thousand years from now. And that thing hasn't really been around as long as some of the other stars that were never that massive when they started. So but the less mass they have, the longer they last. And, it's kind of like driving your car, you know. You know you're running out of gas. You come into the next exit, you push on the gas pedal even harder because, you feel like the faster you go, you're going to make the next exit to get gas. Meanwhile, you're really hurting yourself. You're using up more gas than if you would take it easy. So I think it's that kind of an effect, except, you know, in the star world. Back to you, West, WSOS.
Thank you very much for your time and your help, Dr. Roy and Paul and the audience listening. That's all for me for tonight. Dr. Roy.
Okay, very good. AC2GS. Thank you, Wesley, as always, for your participation. The naming practice for stars is very counterintuitive. Our sun is a population one star. The first stars were population three stars. The intermediates were population two. I'm sure if I was going to name them, I would reverse the order, but that's the way the astronomers work. And they also have a very weird concept of metals. Metals are everything but hydrogen and helium. So when they talk about metals appearing from the core of stars as they burn, they're producing metals. Even sulfur to them is a metal. Everything other than hydrogen and helium are metals. So it's a rather strange thing. Stars can burn hot enough so that they can fuse smaller atoms into iron. Is the largest stable atom that they can generate in their core. They require explosions to generate heavier atoms. Anyway, thank you both for the conversation. I appreciated it. Brian, I hope you're still around. Do you have a question?
1 second, Roy, about the naming of things.
Yeah, Paul.
Yeah, with the brightness of the stars, that's all in reverse to you. So the lower the number, the brighter it is, and then you get into the negative numbers. So, a minus 4 is brighter than a minus 2, you know. You get up to the sun is like a minus 27, you know. You know, that's a backwards world, too. You know, when I tell people the International Space Station is going overhead, you know, I'll tell them, you know, you have a minus 4 magnitude, you know, and a week ago it was a minus 1. You know, somebody might think to themselves, well, it's not worth it, but, you know, it's in reverse. So that's just another example of the astronomer's way of thinking. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, physicists in general have a 50-50 chance a lot of times, and half the time they get it wrong. I mean, you look at a circuit diagram, and you got the current going in the opposite direction to the electrons.
Yeah, that's a classic. Yeah, that's been debated. Yeah, in fact, I just watched a pretty good movie all about Tesla and Edison. You know, it was called the Current Wars. And that's one of the things they talked about for a second or two in the movie, you know, current flow. Anyway, back to you, Ryan.
Okay. I mean, you take the case of, I think it's X-ray spectroscopy. They were able to figure out that there were electron levels. And being cowards, they chose to name the lowest electron level that they could see level G, because they were afraid that it wasn't the lowest. So if they named it A, they'd have to rename it or do something. So the lowest energy level, according to X-ray spectroscopists, is level G, for no apparent reason. Scientists, like I always say, science is a messy thing. When we learn it through science books that clean up most of the mess. But it is a very messy thing indeed. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Wes. Brian, what can I do you for?
Well, I actually kind of forgot already since I was listening and my eyes were slightly closing. So I'm just listening. It's on the side.
Okay, if it comes to you, let me know. Gary, are you still around?
Hey, Roger. I was KACUTF. I was reading today about the passing of Leon Cooper, who was one of the participants in the refinement of the theory of conductivity. And I started to think about MRI machines and how the magnet has to be made of a superconductive metal, which not all metals are capable of, according to what their lattice structure is and whether those molecular structures feature an event or a positive ion, and the formation of Cooper bonds, as they're known, and all this kind of thing. But beyond that, just with regard to the MRI machine itself, the helium, the coolant that is used to make the superconductive magnet inside of a MRI machine. And it occurred to me, given that they have to cool the appropriate metal for superconductivity down to about like 7 degrees above absolute zero, that cannot be occurring inside of an MRI machine. What are there levels of at which you can a form of superconductivity that is not really superconductive by definition?
No. There are two types of superconductors, type 1, type 2. Type 2 are usually have a higher temperature that they superconduct, but they are inherently ceramic, brittle objects that don't really work well, like for an MRI. So they usually use type 1 superconductors, and they bring the temperature down to, I don't remember exactly what the temperature point where it turns superconducting is, but it's pretty low and requires liquid helium. If they could get away with liquid nitrogen or liquid oxygen, they would love to, but they have to get it down to temperatures that only liquid helium can provide.